This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
I'm joined this morning by Connor Smith, a PhD student who's visiting us from the University of Cardiff. Good morning, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, it's great to be here.
Okay, so I should explain at this point, for the benefit of the listeners, that me and Connor are old friends. We did undergrad together at the University of Sussex.
Good days, good days.
Yeah, but we're not here to regale you with those stories this morning.
There's a lot of them we could go through. That's a whole different podcast.
I'm trying to think of a good title, but one doesn't spring to mind. So, what have you been up to since then?
So, since Sussex, I have moved to Cardiff to do my PhD. I am now entering my fourth year, which is still terrifying to say. I have 6 months left on it, even more terrifying. And I've just been busy focusing on my research. And my research focuses on the largest structures in the universe, known as galaxy clusters.
So what exactly are these galaxy clusters that you've been looking at?
So galaxy clusters are some of the largest structures in the universe. So when you have a galaxy, you have a dark matter halo, and that dark matter halo has lots of gas and dust and stars and stuff, and that's a galaxy. Galaxy cluster, essentially that, but a much larger scale. The dark matter halo is huge, one of the most massive objects in the universe. And instead of having gas and dust in the halo, you have galaxies. So these galaxy clusters could weigh 10 to the 15 solar masses, which is like a billion, 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 billion kilograms. And they could be home to thousands and thousands of galaxies. So they're the perfect environment to test so many different things. You can test cosmology. You can look at gravitational lensing, you can study galaxy evolution. They're really useful things.
Okay, so they are useful laboratories for us in
those
senses.
Very, very useful.
So you've been up here in Manchester at the Almanode.
I have, yes.
This week. So what's brought you here?
So my supervisor, Steve Hills, has some ALMA data of a cluster. Well, actually it's a proto-cluster. There's a slight difference, I'll get into that later. And basically, I'm not experienced with ALMA data because it's very difficult, it's very complicated, and you need just to do a whole degree just to understand how to use ALMA and how to produce the data. But luckily there are lots of really good experts up here, for example George Bendo, who's a legend, and he's been helping me reduce my data, getting to a good standard, and trying to extract the data we're interested in.
So what is the data that you're interested in this instance?
So we are looking for the CO transition lines. So galaxies contain lots of gas, and this gas is molecular hydrogen. However, molecular hydrogen you cannot detect for quantum mechanical reasons. So what you do is you use a tracer, in this case it's CO. So basically you try and find CO spectral lines in your data, and from that you can tell many things about the galaxy. The one we're most interested in is the redshift of the galaxy, i.e. how far back in the universe's history is that galaxy.
So you've mentioned that galaxies contain a lot of hydrogen, which obviously they do. If we've got so much of the stuff there, why can't you use that as your tracer instead?
So molecular hydrogen is basically two hydrogens stuck together, and this creates a thing called a dipole. Now, dipoles are very... I'm not an expert on the exact science, but basically, they don't have any rotational transitional lines. So basically, if you have something like CO, for example, that a carbon and oxygen stuck together, the carbon is bigger than the oxygen, so you have an asymmetry, which allows for emission of spectral lines. Molecular hydrogen doesn't do that. It's a symmetrical particle, so it has no dipole moment, and you get no emission.
So when you say spectral lines,
yes,
for the work that I do, I'm used to considering spectral lines in the optical and the near infrared.
Yes.
But I take it you're not looking at those wavelengths.
No. So I focus on submillimeter wavelengths. Now these are wavelengths considered anything from about 0.1 millimeter all the way up to 1 millimeter. And these are very crucial wavelengths because they allow us to probe a galaxy when optical wavelengths can't because of dust.
So this dust would obscure the lines in this case.
So dust is a pain for astronomers, and dust takes the optical light, absorbs it, and we emit it as infrared light. So if we want to, say, example, look at the whole galaxy, say, for example, we want to look at the star formation rate, so how many stars are forming every year, just looking at the optical wavelengths, you can't get the full picture. You need to look at the submillimeter and the far infrared to understand fully what's happening.
So are you expecting to see star formation or anything particularly special in this cluster that you've targeted?
We hope so. So something else we're looking at is a thing. It's a type of galaxy called a submillimeter galaxy. Now, these galaxies are very high abundance in the high redshift universe, and these are very actively star-forming galaxies. So hopefully we should be able to detect high star formation rates in these galaxies I'm trying to look at.
So how high is high redshift in this case?
So this cluster, so we don't actually know the redshift of this cluster I'm working on. That's one of the reasons we want the spectral lines. But based on the photometry of the data, i.e. the images we have, we estimate the redshift to be about redshift 4, which is a look back time of about 11-12 billion years ago.
Okay, so pretty early in the universe's history.
Very early in the universe's history, yes. So it's quite a challenge to actually observe this stuff.
I've just got in my notes here blobs, which you mentioned to me on Monday.
Yes, so
can you tell me about blobs?
I can tell you about blobs. So one of the big problems with submillimeter astronomy is resolution. So if you think back to optics or something, the resolution you can achieve, so basically how well can you resolve individual objects, depends on the wavelength and how big a telescope is. So if you have a very big telescope and a very small wavelength, for example, think about Hubble, that has a 2.5 meter dish and looks at wavelengths of about 500 nanometers, you can achieve really good resolution. We're talking fractions of a fraction of a fraction of a degree. However, when you get to submillimeter wavelengths, you're talking 0.1 millimeter, 0.2 millimeters. The dishes aren't that big. The biggest submillimeter telescope is the JCMT, the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope in Hawaii, which is 15 minutes. And even then, you're only getting 0.1 degree, 0.01 degrees, if you're lucky. So when you observe these galaxies at submillimeter wavelengths, your resolution isn't good enough to resolve any features, so you get a blob.
So what consequences does that then have for you as a researcher trying to understand these objects?
So the biggest issue is you only have global properties of a galaxy. If we have a nearby galaxy, you can understand a lot about, like, for example, how is it rotating? Where is star formation happening? Is it happening in certain areas of a galaxy or all over it? All these sort of stuff you can see in a local galaxy that's resolved. At high redshift, you have one blob, which is only could be a couple of pixels in your image. So you can't make any assumptions on the local structure. You have to be like, well, that's forming X amount of stars a year, and that's all we really know.
So you can't say it's forming X amount of stars per year in these regions?
Yes, that's impossible to say. You can get around that fact with gravitational lensing. So if we have a massive body in front of a faraway galaxy, that massive body will magnify the high redshift galaxy, and you can get more detail. But that's incredibly difficult to model, and people spend their whole lives trying to get it to work, and it's still a bit iffy, but we have to deal with blobs for now.
So you haven't got that case with the protogalaxy that you're observing right now?
So we still have blobs, but because ALM is an interferometer, as I said, the big issue with resolution is if you have a single dish, you're limited by the resolution. ALM is an interferometer, so you have multiple dishes. And when you have multiple dishes staring at one object, that simulates one giant dish. So you can achieve much better resolution. There are some sacrifices you have to make. For example, you lose some structure and stuff. But for the most part, you get the resolution you need. So with our galaxies, because this protocluster was discovered in Herschel images, Herschel has a really poor resolution. When you look at the Herschel images, it's just giant blobs. With the ALM images, we hope that because we have a high resolution because of the interferometer, we hope that those blobs start to break down into individual objects that we can start to resolve. And if we can detect them, we can get a better understanding of the cluster and how it's behaving.
So do you maybe want to talk a little bit about your paper at this point?
So, back in April, I published my first paper.
Congratulations, well done.
I know, it was an ordeal, but the referee was happy, so we did it. So, when you look at a galaxy cluster in the local universe, say for example the Virgo cluster or Thornax, when you look at the distribution of galaxies, you see that clusters are dominated by very red, very elliptical, and non-star-forming galaxies. These are known as red and dead galaxies. And it's believed that these are the end point of galaxy evolution. So you start off with a lovely spiral galaxy, form lots of stars, very blue, and you evolve into a featureless blob that's very red and, let's face it, not doing much. It's, as I said, in the local universe, clusters are dominated by these red and dead galaxies. But obviously, at some point in time, as you go back further and further, these elliptical galaxies had been star-forming at some point. It makes logical sense. So, what I do is I look at high redshift clusters. In this case, it's a redshift 2 cluster, which is a look-back time of about 9 billion years. And basically, I use sublimated images from the SCUBA 2 instrument on the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope. And basically, I try and see, are there any star-forming galaxies in this cluster? And turns out there is.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of star-forming galaxies, and this is very important for several reasons. The first one is, we believe that these elliptical galaxies, the progenitors of these elliptical galaxies, are the sublimated galaxies I mentioned earlier. And if we detect sublimated galaxies in a cluster of high redshift, this essentially confirms this theory, because those galaxies eventually evolve into an elliptical galaxy, thus showing that sublimated galaxies are the progenitors to elliptical galaxies. The other thing is it allows us to understand galaxy evolution. So, galaxy evolution is still a bit of a mystery. We don't really understand what's happening. And there are certain effects that can essentially speed up galaxy evolution. For example, in the cluster, clusters are filled with very hot X-ray gas. Because the dark matter halo is so big, as gas falls into it, that gas heats up, and it gets so hot, it emits X-rays. So if you have a galaxy full of cold gas, and that meets the hot gas in the cluster, many, many things can happen. Stuff like ram pressure stripping, where the gas gets ripped out. You have tidal interactions, where galaxies orbit each other and cause gravitational instabilities in each other. And many other things can happen. So if we look at high redshift and be like, well, these are all star-forming galaxies, and we look at a slightly lower redshift cluster, it's like, these are all elliptical galaxies. We can be like, well, something must be happening in the middle, and we can put time constraints on those processes and be like, well, this takes X amount of years to happen, that can't be happening, this takes blah amount of years, and we can piece everything together to try and understand how galaxy evolution works.
So you can infer a timescale for it?
Yes, exactly.
And so then this is all with the submillimeter tracers that you mentioned earlier with the data.
Yeah. And submillimeter actually has another advantage I completely forgot to mention, is that when you have optical wavelengths, if you have a very high redshift object, as the light comes to you, that light begins to dim. And so when you have, say for example, optical, when the light actually reaches you, it's a lot dimmer and you have to have a long integration time to detect it. Submillimeter doesn't actually suffer from that problem. As you go to longer and longer wavelengths, your source will have the same brightness. So you can do a lot less integration time, but still achieve the same brightness. So it's actually really useful.
One other question I should have asked a bit earlier. Are there any other tracers that you can use besides CO?
So you can try and do optical spectroscopy on these galaxies, but it would take many, many, many hours. And I don't think any tech would appreciate going to say, can I use Hubble for 500 hours, please? You probably get laughed out the door. So CO is really the only tracer we can use.
I suppose I should say, for the benefit of the listeners at this point, is that the TAC is the Time Allocation Committee. So with all of that coming together, I assume that the write-up is in progress?
Have you not heard? We don't talk about the T word. So yeah, so my thesis is slowly coming together. But yes, I should be finished within the next 6 months, which is terrifying, but I think it'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be.
Yeah, I'm not too worried.
So do you have any thoughts about where you might go next? Do you think you might stay in academia?
I don't plan on staying in academia. I personally just Stonefall was the best fit for me. I'm just going to keep my options open. I've started applying for jobs so far. Probably, you know, data analyst, data science, those sort of fields. Mm. So, yeah, that's going to be my fun job for the next few months. If anyone out there wants to hire me, you know, I'm great.
I suspect that's where I will go as well, yeah, if academia doesn't work out for whatever reason.
You'll be fine.
Yeah, there is a life after astronomy.
There really is. People, PhD students, you don't have to stay in academia.
I guess that feels like a good place to leave it.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
No worries.